Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Adria Breyer, a member of the club's Health and Medicine member-led forum and chair of tonight's program. It's my pleasure to extend a very special welcome to any new club members who are here and to all of those who I've seen many faces over and over again. Thank you for supporting our programs. At this time, please turn off your cell phones and any other noise-making devices. We have a program coming up on July 29th. My new physician is a DO, and what is osteopathic medicine? That program will be presented by Michael Clearfield, Mitchell Hizzerotto, Michelle Rayfield, and Shelley Berkeley. I invite you to check our website for a list of all the upcoming programs. One of the people who will be speaking at the end of October, and you're hearing it before anybody else, is Dr. Michael Roizen. His reputation is incredible, and the guy is awesome. You can find out what that date's going to be. It's going to be somewhere around the 21st or 22nd of October. You can register for programs online at commonwealthclub.org or by calling the club's 24-hour reservation line. We're passing around program cards so you can ask your questions. They'll be collected, and I'll read the questions to Dr. Turner after about 45 minutes. By the way, tonight there is a special membership price of $79 for an individual membership, and there's also family memberships. I'm sure it's not only tonight, but it is a special probably $40 off, and it's so well worth it. Our programs are generally podcast, and you can find them on the commonwealthclub.org website. I have been waiting years for Dr. Kelly Turner to come to this club. I met Kelly in 2006 when I had the first episode of cancer diagnosed, and I went to an oncologist, and I could not have asked for anybody to support me better. At a time when someone is diagnosed with cancer, we are not only in terror, but we're downloaded with all the fears of our parents that people are going to have to die and you must have only four choices, radiation, chemotherapy, surgery, and drugs. And when I went to Kelly, I told her that that was not my paradigm. And lo and behold, somebody was really there to support me when I was trying not to drown. At that time, I realized what an incredible therapist Kelly would be for anybody who had the good fortune to be with her. I ultimately went on to counsel in healthier approaches to cancer worldwide. And had I not had that kind of support, I might not be here. I did not know what Kelly would go on to do, that she would touch people around the world. She was touching me, and I thought she'd be a therapist and she'd touch individuals. We're very fortunate in our lifetime to meet people who make a life difference. As I said before, when people are diagnosed with cancer, they think they're going to die. That's what they're told. That's what our parents were told. They didn't even tell the neighbors, because you couldn't tell the neighbors. They might move away. It could be catchy. Kelly went around the world interviewing people who had conquered cancer, and they conquered it, and she called her book Radical Remission, because there are people who lived who conquered cancer. There was nobody out there doing what Kelly did. There was nobody to break the paradigm, to give the people with cancer and their families hope. And this amazing, heart-filled woman changed her life to go around the world with her family to bring that information to all of us. I speak for thousands of people with gratefulness, Kelly. Her interest in complementary medicine began when she received a BA from Harvard, and then she got a PhD at the University of California in Berkeley. Her dissertation research took her to 10 countries. She interviewed 50 alternative healers and 20 radical remission cancer survivors about their healing techniques. Her research is ongoing, and she has gone on to interview 100 survivors and analyze over 1,000 cases of radical remission. She has founded the Radical Remission Project, which is an innovative website that I ask everyone to look at, to share with other people, to make it a network, put it on YouTube, do whatever you can do to share this information, because we need the support to know that we who have had episodes of cancer can live and can thrive, and this is a great vehicle to do it. Her website is www.radicalremission.com. She lives with her family in New York City. You can visit her website, drkellyturner.com. Kelly's book has been translated into 17 languages. Let's talk about worldwide desire. She's been a Amazon number one bestseller. She's been on Dr. Oz twice. She's also been her book has been a New York Times bestseller. It is with a great deal of pleasure that I introduce you to Dr. Kelly Turner.
Thank you all for coming tonight, and thank you for inviting me, Adria. She's been asking me to come speak here for years, and I said, well, as soon as I get another chance to come out to the Bay Area, I will definitely make a stop here. So I'm going to be teaching this weekend a two-day workshop, and so I called Adria, and I said, I'm coming out to the Bay Area, and she said, let me call the Commonwealth Club. So, so here we are. Today I'm just going to give sort of a brief overview of my research, and then most importantly I want to hear your questions, because I know some people here are health providers, some people here are cancer patients, some people here are cancer survivors or friends and family, and you all have different needs and different questions, and there's no way I can give a presentation that's going to please all of you. So definitely think of your questions and write them down. Good. So, what is radical remission? Radical remission is known as spontaneous remission in the medical field. It is a remission from cancer that occurs in the absence of Western medicine or after Western medicine has failed. These have been occurring since the beginning of medical journals. So the very first medical journal in 1895, there was a case of spontaneous remission of cancer reported. So it's been reported for over 100 years. Across all different types of cancer. When I started looking into this, there were over 1,500 cases in the medical literature, but nobody was looking at all of them together, and nobody was looking at them in depth. These case reports, if you look them up, are very brief. They're written by doctors who very bravely took the time to write up a case report that said, this person healed, and I have no idea why. But that's about as far as the case reports go. And I was a counselor. I was getting my master's in counseling at UC Berkeley, specifically training in counseling cancer patients. And my cancer patients were asking me, what can I do to get better? What can, you know, should I reduce stress? You know, what can I do emotionally, but also what can I eat? And I, you know, can I eat broccoli? And what if, you know, they were asking me all these questions. And I said, I don't know. I don't know. But I will find out for you. Because you are hooked up to a chemo machine and I'm not. And so I went back to Berkeley and I talked to my professors and I said, there are 1,500 of these cases that no one's really investigating. Can I get my PhD and study this? And they looked at me like I was crazy. And they said, well, if you can find funding for it. And I thankfully convinced the American Cancer Society to fund my research. So thanks to them and thanks to the support of Berkeley, I was able to get my PhD in this and really study these cases in depth. So that's what radical remission is. Adria said everything about me, basically. I'm just someone who got interested in mind-body medicine at Harvard. I had the blessing of studying under Professor Ann Harrington, who has done fascinating research on the history of mind-body medicine. And that really set off a light bulb in me that there's more going on to health than just drugs and surgery. And that led me into the world of counseling and helping people get through health crises, help support them on their emotional journey, which is something that happens whenever you go through a health crisis. And then, of course, finding out about these cases and being really pissed off that no one was looking at them. They say it takes a little bit of fire and anger to get you to do something in life. Well, I was pretty confused as to why these people are healing from stage 4 cancer after being sent home on hospice. And we're all here trying to win the war on cancer. Well, here's 1,500 people who've won the war on cancer in an incredible way. And we're just going to ignore them. We're just going to say, oh, I don't know, that was a fluke. Well, that wasn't good enough for me. And so I went and did this research. So what did I find? So I interviewed Well, let me explain my research methods, first of all. When you have a medical phenomenon or a scientific phenomenon that is inexplicable, meaning there are no hypotheses for it, you can't do a clinical trial. And I know that clinical trials are the gold standard of scientific research, and I'm actually in talks with universities about how to set up a clinical trial to test the results of my research. But without any hypotheses, you have to go to step one of the scientific method. Does anyone remember what step one of the scientific method is?
Gather data.
Observe. Yeah. Observation. Deep observation. So when we don't know why something is happening, we just need to sit back and observe. So the type of research methods that were appropriate were qualitative research methods, also known as anthropological research methods. So just like an anthropologist would go into the jungles of Borneo and find a new tribe of people that we've never seen before, and they would, you know, try to learn their language and be accepted and just observe and just take notes. That's what I did with radical remission survivors. I gained their trust. I went and got translators to speak their language, and I asked them one very simple question. Why do you think you healed? And you know what they said to me? They said, you are the first person to ask me that. My doctor didn't want to know. And we can, that's a whole other discussion as to why the doctor wouldn't want to know. But they were so anxious and eager to tell me their story. I thought I was going to have a hard time getting people to tell me their medical history. Oh, no, no, no. These people talk for hours. It was very, very easy to get them to tell me their healing story. And my goal was simply to be a true blank slate so that they could tell me anything, even if it sounded, quote, unquote, crazy. And after doing this many, many times in qualitative research, you see themes that come up over and over again. So I found 75 different things that these people did to get well. But not everyone did all 75. But when I looked at the frequency of the factors, these 75 factors, I found that everybody that I studied in depth was doing 9 of them. They weren't all doing number 10. And then they definitely weren't all doing number 11. And only one guy was doing number 75. But they were all doing these eight or nine. And so these are the 9 that I put into my dissertation and that I then turned into the book. So these are hypotheses only. It's very important that you know this. Qualitative research is meant to gather hypotheses when hypotheses are absent. And with spontaneous remission, that was the problem. We didn't know why these remissions were happening. Now we have 9 possible explanations that now need to be tested in clinical trials. So I'll be sharing those 9 hypotheses with you tonight. The other thing I found out is that underreporting is real when it comes to radical remission. All right. If you talk to any doctor, they're going to say, yeah, that happens, but it's incredibly, incredibly rare. And according to the medical literature, it is. But there is no way to track or report these cases in the National Cancer Registry. So we don't actually know how often these cases are happening. And for a case to show up in a medical journal, it means that the doctor, who doesn't know why this person got well, decided to take approximately 40 hours of unpaid time to write up a case report, collect all the material, submit it to a journal, and then the journal has to accept it, which is a case report with no hypothesis, and many of them are rejected. So I estimate that for every one case that's published, there are 100 more that have gone unpublished. Every single person that I have researched has been unpublished. The exception is one person who is now, as a result of talking with me and going on this journey, he has now convinced the dean of Harvard Medical School to publish his case. But all of the rest of the people that I've studied have not been published in medical journals. So I want to get through the 9 factors. I'm just going to give you an overview and talk about some of the other scientific studies that back up why these factors might be helpful to the immune system. So 9 is a lot. So I like to talk about these in groups of 3. So we're going to talk about 3 that I call the foundation, then we're going to talk about 3 physical factors and 3 emotional factors. So the foundational factors, the first one is having strong reasons for living. So everyone that I studied had very, very strong reasons for living. And what I found interesting about the people I was interviewing is that they weren't talking about being afraid of death. Some of them were very afraid of death. Some of them weren't. That was not the common thread. The common thread is that they all had things they wanted to do. So, for example, I had some people who said, I'm not afraid to die when it's my time, you know, it's my time. But until that happens, until whenever that day comes, I've got things I want to do, and I'm going to do them. So they cared about the things they wanted to do more than they feared death. So it's not about getting rid of your fear of death necessarily. Some of them didn't. They just sort of distracted themselves from it by focusing on things that they really wanted to do, that they really enjoyed. In terms of the studies behind this, there isn't a lot of studies about specifically having strong reasons for living. But there are tons of studies out there about depression in cancer patients. And depression, of course, can be defined as someone who has lost the will to live. That's actually, if you look in the DSM, that's one of the criteria, someone who doesn't have the will to function, to engage in life. So depressed cancer patients live about half as long as non-depressed cancer patients. That's a very scary statistic. But the good news is that there have been a few studies where they take depressed cancer patients, separate them into a control and a treatment group, and then they treat the depression through group psychotherapy. And the ones who are treated for with psychotherapy for their depression live longer, almost twice as long, than the ones who aren't treated. So the good news is that we can, if we have a cancer patient who doesn't have strong reasons for living, we can do some interventions with them, try to get them to get back in touch with why they might want to keep living, and that might actually increase their chances. So whenever I give talks, I always try to get people to, you know, apply it to their own life a little bit, if you want. It's optional. But I just think it sometimes helps to get these messages to sink in if you actually think about it for yourself as well. So I just invite you to think for a minute about what are your top three reasons for living. Just make a mental list and see if you can come up with three. The second factor that's part of this foundational set is taking control of your health. So all the people I interviewed were very, very active about how they were going to get better. Now, it's important to note that they didn't all start this way. Many of the people that I studied who were sent home on hospice started off very passive. They listened to their doctors. They did whatever their doctor said. They were very good patients, quote, unquote, good patients. But then when you're sent home on hospice and your doctor says, there's nothing more I can do for you, then these people had to start saying, well, what can I do for myself? What should I do? And some of them just took little baby steps, and they started drinking filtered water, and that made them feel better. And then they started eating more vegetables, and that made them feel better. And so they started taking baby steps, but they, little by little, took control of their healing process. A good example of this is Vanessa Lukes from New Zealand. I had the great fortune of meeting her in Christchurch before the earthquake. She's a colon cancer survivor, stage 3 colon cancer survivor. She was diagnosed in her late 20s. And she was very confused because she was so healthy. She was an exercise nut, and she was basically a vegetarian. And so she was really confused. And she said, I'm doing everything right. How did I get this? And so she, you know, was upset for a little bit and frustrated. And then she said, you know, I'm just going to have to do some research and try to figure this out. So she went to the library and started researching healing and all types of healing. And she, who had never explored the idea of emotional stress, mind-body healing, she started reading books on that, and it really resonated for her. And what she found out for her, I think maybe that was the problem that one was on, what she found out for her is that she had a lot of healing to do over the death of her father, and that for her healing, she needed to do that. And that was the key for her, because she already had the exercise and the diet and all that stuff in place. She needed to move into the more emotional, energetic realm. And she ended up, her modality that worked for her was Qigong, and she's now a Qigong master. So, and I'm, you know, that was her path to healing. That's not everyone's. But it just goes to show you that there's always more ways that you can take control of your health. And if you want to try taking control of your health a little bit more, I really encourage everyone I meet to familiarize yourself with the PubMed site, pubmed.gov. This is Google for medical journals, and it is free and open to lay people. So it's yours. Your tax dollars are paying for this search engine, and you can just go there, and you could just type in tonight, cancer space yoga, or cancer space meditation, or cancer space diet. And you'll see all the most recent studies that are on that topic, and you can read the abstracts. So it's just a good exercise to get familiar. And, you know, the jargon of these abstracts, just open up a separate window with dictionary.com and teach yourself, because jargon is just jargon. You'll learn it. You know, it's this stuff isn't does not need to be inaccessible. All right, and moving on to the third factor that's in this foundational set is embracing social support. So everyone that I interviewed experienced an increase in social support. Some of them actively worked for that and asked for it, and other people just received it. They were just flooded with love and support from family and friends. But whether or not they created it or just received it, the common thread of all the people I studied was that they experienced an increase in social support. So, social support is a funny thing in scientific literature. It boggles social scientists because it is so protective for health. Let me give you an example. There's a community in Italy on an island off of Sicily that they're the oldest one of the oldest people in the world. They all live to 100 and stuff. So researchers are, you know, studying who are these people living over 100 all around the world. They find this island in Sicily, and these people are having cheesy lasagna every night together. They're eating together communally in groups of 30 or 40. They're cooking together. They're cleaning up together. They're drinking lots of red wine, followed by the aperitifs or whatever. And then they're smoking cigars. And they're not exercise nuts. They just walk about a mile a day. And so the researchers were like, these guys are smoking, they're not exercising too much, and they're eating meat and cheese. What is going on? And they tested them for all these different things. They looked at their blood. They looked at everything. Guess what it was? Social support. The power of oxytocin, which is a chemical that we are, as researchers, just starting to uncover the power of, is mind-boggling. Oxytocin is the elixir of health. And oxytocin is released when we feel loved and supported by family and friends. So don't underestimate the importance of having a meal with friends. And if you want to do an exercise for this, I just encourage you to do something in person this week. And this counts. You guys are in person. But you have to meet somebody here tonight. So before you go, if you might see a familiar face, you might see a new face, just make sure you don't leave until you've met at least one person. Okay? All right, so moving on to part two. So those were the first three. And now the second three are physical. The first one, as you can probably guess, is radically changing your diet. So all of us, me especially, expected this one to come up, right? So people who are healing from cancer without Western medicine, I figured they're just eating broccoli all the time. So yes, changing your diet was certainly a common thread. But everybody was doing slightly different things. But when I stood back and looked at the general trends, what I found is they were greatly reducing or even eliminating meat, wheat, sweets, and dairy. And by wheat, I mean gluten. What do these things have in common? They are all inflammatory. And what we are finding is that inflammation is the perfect breeding ground for cancer cells. So I'm not saying that these things, no one is saying that these things cause cancer, but they make it very hospitable for cancer to grow. What did they replace them with? Veggies and fruits. Veggies and fruits. Veggies and fruits. It's like there's no vegetable you can't eat. There's no fruit you can't eat. Like, just eat them. That's what they told me. And a good example of this is this gentleman submitted his healing story to our research website, radicalremission.com. And Larry was diagnosed with very aggressive prostate cancer back in 2005. And his doctor said, you need an immediate radical prostatectomy. We need to take your entire prostate out. And then we need to follow with chemotherapy, radiation, and hormone therapy. And he was like, whoa, okay, this is a lot. Let me think about this. And he went and he took control of his health and did a little bit of reading. He came back a couple days later and he said, you know, I want to try some diet stuff first. Can you just give me, you know, a month or so? And the doctor said, look, it's your decision, but I think you're crazy. So he knew that things were serious, and so he went really serious with the diet. He did something called the Gerson Protocol, which many of you may know about. It works for some people. It doesn't work for everyone, but it worked for Larry. And that was juicing vegetables, especially carrot juice, coffee enemas, going mostly vegan, and carrot juice was big. He went like even more than what the Gerson recommended. He drank a lot of carrot juice. He turned orange. But anyway, a month later, his markers were going down, and his doctor said, okay, I'll monitor you. So he's now cancer-free, and he never had any treatment. So that worked for him. Doesn't work for everyone, but it is a case worth studying. And no one had ever studied him before he came to my website. His, you know, his doctor was proud of him, but hadn't reported it in a journal. So if you want to try eating like radical remission survivors do, simple exercise is to try to make sure that half of every plate is fruits and vegetables. Every plate, that includes breakfast. So let me show you what I mean. This is the typical American breakfast, right? Do you guys see any vegetables? Do you see any fruits? Right? But there's protein, right? Well, we're a little protein crazed. We don't need that much protein. What we need are fruits and vegetables. This is what a radical remission survivor would eat for breakfast. They'd eat a organic, pasture-raised, very healthy, healthy egg, just one. They'd eat some whole grain oatmeal, steel-cut oatmeal, and then they'd eat half their plate would be fruit. Typical American lunch, right? Tuna salad sandwich with a pickle, and everyone's like, oh, the pickle's a vegetable. Not really. This is how radical remission survivors eat lunch. They have a vegetable-rich salad that's not just lettuce. Then their protein could be something like hummus, and their grain is something like whole wheat pita bread. And, of course, the big American dinner, steak, potatoes, a little bit of carrots. Just change it around, right? The radical remission survivors that I study would eat more like this. Half of their plate would be the vegetables. There'd be two vegetables, different color vegetables. Then they'd have a quarter of brown rice, and they'd have a small portion of grass-fed, hormone-free, antibiotic-free meat. So some of them do eat meat, but they make sure it's really as healthy of meat and locally butchered as they can get it. All right, moving on. Number five, taking herbs and supplements. And we really are, where's Bill? We are blessed to have Bill Grant in the audience back there. Bill is a researcher on vitamin D, specifically on vitamin D and cancer. So vitamin D is obviously the vitamin that we naturally produce when we're exposed to the sun, and many of us no longer work in farm fields all day. So as humans, we're spending most of our time indoors, and most of us are very vitamin D deficient. And what Bill has found, and many other researchers have found, is that many cancer patients, when they're diagnosed with cancer, their immune systems are fine. They have enough white blood cells and red blood cells, but they're actually very low on things like vitamin D, melatonin, and trace minerals. So the types of herbs and supplements that the people I studied used varied widely across the board. All right, not everybody was taking the same supplement. 15? Okay, yeah, perfect. But it fell into three categories. They took herbs and supplements that helped them detoxify things that shouldn't be in their body. These are things like heavy metals, parasites, bacteria. Then they took herbs and supplements that helped them digest all those wonderful vegetables they were eating. So probiotics, prebiotics, digestive enzymes, things like that. And finally, things that helped really boost their immune system. So vitamin D, melatonin, mushroom extracts, cannabis oil, noni fruit, soursop fruit, you name it. They were vitamin C drips, IV drips. It, you know, varied widely across the board. People in the Caribbean were taking soursop fruit. People in Hawaii were taking the noni fruit. People in Japan were taking mushrooms. So they were taking the herbs, the plants that were from their native land that were known to fight cancer. Why are they doing this? Well, here's one good reason. So today's peaches have 40% fewer vitamins and minerals than they did 50 years ago. I'm not talking about an organic peach that's been grown on properly fertilized soil in a local small field. Those are good. But your typical, you know, peach that's been picked right, you know, far before it was ripe down in Chile and shipped up to your Safeway has 40% fewer vitamins and minerals than it did 50 years ago. And if you ask your grandparents, they'll tell you that. They say, oh, the fruit doesn't taste like it used to. The tomatoes these days are terrible. And so that's why these things might be needed, because the food that we're eating is just simply not as nutritious. And it's also filled with pesticides. So there have been some controversial studies about, is organic food really more nutritious? Well, there have been some studies that show maybe it's not significantly more nutritious, but it is always shown to be significantly filled with less pesticides, always, in every study. So if you want to start taking supplements, you have to go see someone. have, this is the one factor of the nine that you can't do on your own tonight. You have to see a qualified health professional. That could be a Chinese medicine herbalist. That could be your, you know, local homeopath, or it could be a naturopath or a nutritionist. Doesn't matter. But you need to see someone who's qualified to figure out what your body needs, because you might need detoxification and your neighbor might need boosting. But one thing that you can all do tomorrow morning, I promise, and I'm not a doctor, but I promise it's going to be okay, is you can have room temperature or warm water with lemon. It is a wonderful supplement that will help cleanse your liver, which you need to do in the morning because your liver has been cleaning house all night. So that's just something you can try if you want tomorrow morning. A lot of people who have trouble getting off coffee, if they do warm water with lemon half hour before their coffee, they realize they only need one cup and not three. Okay, moving right along to intuition. And you might be like, wait, I thought there were three physical factors. So intuition is interesting, and I put it here on purpose because I want people to know what I didn't know, which is that intuition is a physical phenomenon that happens in the human body. So when intuition came up over and over again in my interviews, I was really kind of surprised and a little resistant. I was like, this is too woo-woo. Why is this in every interview? You know? That I had to get over that, because as a qualitative researcher, you bring no bias to the table. And I said, well, as a researcher, let me try to figure out what's happening here. Well, here's what I figured out. Intuition is right here, the base of your brain. This is your reptilian brain. It's the oldest part of your brain. See how it looks different than everything else? So it's called the reptilian brain because it's very, very old. This whole frontal part of our brain, in evolutionary terms, is quite new. But this back part has been around forever. If you believe in evolution, it's been around since we were reptiles. So this is the part of your brain that does not think rationally. It acts instantly to save your life. This is the part of your brain where if you run into the middle of the street and save a child from being hit by a car, and you're interviewed by the news afterwards, and you say, I don't know what came over me, I just did it, I didn't think. That's the back of your brain. That's the reptilian part of your brain. Your intuition is also located in your gut in the form of 100 million neurons. That's the same amount of neurons that are in your brain. So we have a second brain that's in our digestive tract. So when you have a gut feeling, you are actually thinking and feeling from your gut, from those 100 million neurons. So intuition is very much a physical part of being human. But here's the kicker. It only really comes on when our life is threatened. And that's what I didn't know. But that's what, when I started researching it, I understood this part of the brain doesn't really turn on in normal U.S. life, right? Because thankfully we don't have the threat of bombs every day like some countries do. So this part of our brain is only activated when our life is in danger. And then the light bulb went off for me and I was like, oh, I get it. Because when cancer patients are told you have cancer, that is a death threat in our society. That sentence is life-threatening. So when I had totally, quote-unquote, normal people in my interview saying, Dr. Turner, please don't think I'm crazy. But I started hearing a voice in my head. They're like, I swear I don't normally hear voices. But right after I was diagnosed, I heard a voice. And it told me, you've got to move. So one of my interviewees had this voice that just said, you've got to move, you've got to move. He'd been in his house for 30 years. And he loved his house, and he loved his community. And he's like, what? So he ended up following it, and he moved to a totally different climate. He was in sort of damp northeast, and he moved to the arid southwest. We'll talk about that study in a minute. And it turned out that the house he'd been living in for 30 years had toxic mold in the walls, which may or may not have caused his cancer, but it certainly was compromising his immune system. And so it's important to listen to that voice because, and here's why we should listen to that voice, because studies have been done on this voice, on this part of our brain, this intuition, that show that this part of our brain knows the path to safety long before the front of our brain even knows there's a problem. So let me just give you a real quick example, and then I'll get going. This was a study done by Cornell, and they were very hesitant to publish it because they couldn't believe the results. And they said, well, we're Cornell. People are going to think we're crazy. But they had to publish it because it was good research. So they were testing intuition, and they had people sit in front of a computer that had two curtains on it, red curtains. And they said, try to guess which object the curtain is behind, which curtain the object is behind. They also had them hooked up to sensors. So they had their palms hooked up, and they had their heart rate measured and everything. So the computer was randomly generating which curtain the object would go behind, and they did this exercise about 20 times. So you had 20 clicks. The body always knew the right answer. Let me repeat that. The person's body always knew the right answer. The sweat glands would open up. The heart rate would become more variable when they moved the mouse over the wrong answer. When they moved the mouse over the right answer, the sweat glands would close up very imperceptibly, and the heart rate would become nice and smooth and regular. So the body always knew. But the front of the mind often took over, and the person was like, well, no, it can't be that one, because I guessed that last time. And it's been that one 3 times in a row, so it's got to be this one. So they didn't necessarily follow what their bodies were telling them, nor could they necessarily sense that very small level of intuition. But their bodies knew. And then here's the really crazy part. Their bodies knew 2 to 3 seconds before the computer had decided which curtain to put it behind. So the body was predicting the correct answer in the future. And I can show you guys that study. It's really mind-blowing. So if you want to practice this, I don't suggest putting yourself in life-threatening situations. That's not a good way to turn this on. But it is there, and it's just dormant. And you can turn it on by flexing that muscle. And a very simple way to do that is just try to guess who's calling. So when your phone rings, before you look at it, just try to, without thinking about it, try to guess who's calling. That's one easy way to start flexing that muscle. Okay. The third part, which I always say for the end, which means I'm always running out of time. So even though I'm rushing through these, please don't think they're not important. The emotional mental factors that came up over and over again. The first was releasing suppressed emotions. These are things like stress, anxiety, fear, regret, sadness. One of the things that came up over and over again with both the survivors that I interviewed, and also the healers that I interviewed, was this theory. This is a theory from various different traditional medicine systems that says illness of any kind is a blockage. It's a blockage on the emotional level, the energetic level, the physical level, or the spiritual level. But at some level, if you are sick, there is a blockage. So that blockage could be caused by a physical thing, like a toxin, or it could, according to them, be caused by an emotional thing, like unresolved grief. So that's the theory, take it or leave it. What do we know scientifically about this? Well, there's been lots of studies done on stress management, and specifically stress management with cancer patients. Over and over again, the cancer patients who go through a stress management course, which is usually 6 to 8 weeks, 2 hours a week for 6 to 8 weeks, have significantly higher natural killer cells at the end of the course than the same cancer patients with the same type of cancer who don't take the course. So these are controlled studies, and they show over and over again, if you manage your stress, your immune system will get stronger. So that's one possible explanation for why the people that I study help their immune systems get well by releasing emotions. Powerful example here is Emily. Emily was diagnosed with stage 4 cervical cancer, which means it had metastasized to other parts of her body. And after her hysterectomy, her doctor said, we need to get you in for chemo in 2 weeks. I'll let you recover for 2 weeks. And she thought, okay. She went home and she said, I don't want to do chemo. My body feels too weak. I've been trained in energy healing, and so I need to try to work on this. And so she called in all of her energy healing friends, and they did everything they could think of. They did Reiki, they did, you know, emotional release work. And what she realized in those 2 weeks is that she was so angry and hurt from her nasty divorce that she had just recently gone through. And she hadn't processed that. So she spent those 2 weeks only working on releasing the grief and the anger and the hurt from her divorce. When she went back 2 weeks later to get checked and to start chemo, her metastases were gone. Yeah, they were gone. So could that have been a result of the surgery? Perhaps. There are some doctors who would say the surgery kicked her immune system into gear, and that could very well be true. But I don't think we should overlook the fact that those 2 weeks were spent very heavily releasing some very painful emotions that she was carrying in her body. And if you want to try releasing suppressed emotions, one of the best ways to do it is to exercise. So however you like to exercise, whether it's running or dancing or twirling, it's a wonderful way to release suppressed emotions that are held in your body. All right, moving along to increasing positive emotions. The people that I studied said over and over again that this requires daily practice. It's just like going to the gym. It's just like working out. If you don't do it every day, you're going to fall off the wagon, and eventually you're not going to be exercising. Well, what they said is if you don't work on being happy every day, you're not going to be happy. It's like a muscle, they said. You have to get it strong. And they said that, and then the next thing they said is, but you don't have to be happy all day. You don't have to be happy all day. It's impossible when you're going through cancer. You're so afraid. The people that I studied spent like weeks or months in fear. Deep fear, fear of death. The deepest, the strongest fear there is. But they said, even in those darkest months, I took at least 5 minutes a day to distract myself from that fear and laugh about something. Okay? So that I'm just reporting from the field. That's what they do. How might this work? Well, we know that chemo patients who are going through chemo, who are shown funny videos during chemo, compared to those who aren't, have significantly higher white blood cells at the end of chemo. So they're bouncing back faster, perhaps because of the laughter. Now, when we laugh, we release oxytocin and serotonin and dopamine and all these wonderful immune boosters. So it makes sense. I'm going to skip Gemma's example because I want to make sure we get to the last factor. In terms of increasing positive emotions, I usually tell a joke to try to get you to practice laughing. Because have all of you been happy for 5 minutes yet today? Okay, so I'll tell you a quick joke. Okay, so this woman is pregnant with twins, and she gives birth, and immediately after birth, she goes into a coma. Very scary, you know, it's a terrible thing. So she's in a coma for about 2 months, and, you know, her husband's there, and her brother really steps in and really helps to care for these twins. And so she wakes up, and they say, "You're fine. You know, it's just this fluke, and the twins are fine, and your brother's been so helpful taking care of them." And she's like, "Oh, my gosh, thank you. So what did you name them?" And her brother says, "Well, I named the girl Denise." She goes, "Oh, Denise, that's a beautiful name. Thank you. Well, what did you name my boy?" He looked at her, and he goes, "De-nephew." Denise, De-nephew. So anyway, it's a corny joke, but it got most of you smiling. So you're welcome for the oxytocin. All right, last but not least is deepening spiritual connection. So again, I wasn't surprised that this came up, but it came up in various different ways. Everybody had a different way that they were connecting to spirit. And most importantly for me as a researcher, they weren't discussing their beliefs. They were talking about a feeling that they got in their bodies when they did this spiritual practice. So this really became a physical experience for them, and that physical experience was very slow breathing, almost like they didn't have to breathe. Very slow heart rate, empty mind, no thoughts. They felt that their mind was silent. They felt that their body was slow and peaceful. And then they emotionally started to feel joy pouring through their body. So this is something that they described, whether they were meditating or praying or doing whirling dervish. They all described this physical experience. And what we know from studying people who do these spiritual connection practices is that once you do this practice and you get into this state, which is it's a very deep experience of the relaxation response, right? So we have fight or flight, or we have relaxation. Well, when you do something like prayer or meditation, you take that relaxation response and you deepen it. And what we found is that people who've never meditated before, who meditate for half an hour a day for 8 weeks, at the end of those 8 weeks, they have turned off their disease-promoting genes. Okay, this is a wonderful field of research called epigenetics. You can control your genes because you can control whether they're turned on or off. And meditation for 8 weeks, turned off disease-promoting genes. I'm talking about oncogenes, cancer genes. So it's really important to find a practice that gets you into this physical experience because it physically, radically changes your immune system. And I'm going to skip the example. You can read Donna's example on my website. Her spiritual connection practice was painting. It's not meditation. But she was sent home on hospice, had a dream that God was going to take care of her, and he told her, just paint. She woke up, she painted every day, which was her favorite hobby, and her cancer went away. Do we know why Donna healed? No. But painting for her led her to a place where she was breathing slowly, she wasn't thinking, she was just in the moment. So if you want to practice this tonight, one of my favorite meditations for beginners is the Let Go meditation, where you just sit quietly, close your eyes, and on the inhale you think let, and on the exhale you think go. So you're just letting go. Letting go of stress, letting go of everything. Okay, so that's it. For me, just a quick update on where things are going now is the website's continuing to collect research and collect cases, and you can go read them if you want to. We're turning it into a film, a feature film, not a documentary, but a fictionalized film. And then we're also working on a docuseries. So lots of new ways to try to get this message out that these people are healing in ways that we can't yet explain. But hopefully if we keep studying them in depth, we will be able to explain exactly why they healed. It's one of my favorite quotes from Albert Einstein. You can't solve a problem on the same level at which it was created. And so I think to really understand radical remissions, we need to go deeper. We need to go to a deeper level and try to figure out why these people healed. So thank you very much. And we'll have time for questions. How can we launch a revolution to make complementary medicine the norm? Oh, that's a tough one. You know, I think in the end, it's got to come from both directions. It has to come from the top down, but it also needs to come from the bottom up. I think a lot of people in this room can work from the bottom up, and you can, you know, talk to your doctor and say, you know, can you write up this person's story, or have you had a case like this in your practice, and why haven't you written up, and can I help you write it up? You can go to websites and contribute and say, I've had this experience with these mushrooms, or I've had, you know, this positive experience with diet. Just let people know from the ground up how you're healing. And then I think we need to work with universities and convince them to try to study these factors in a clinical trial. It's difficult. There are ethical issues with not giving people who have cancer treatment. But I think creatively we can come up with a solution for that.
To the point that you just mentioned, is there a mic there?
Yeah.
To the point that you just mentioned, are doctors not required to only address those four elements or be in jeopardy of their license?
Yeah, that's another problem, is that doctors are not allowed to not prescribe surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. They can go to jail for that. So I've talked to oncologists at Sloan Kettering, where I live in New York, and they say to their patients, you know, okay, we're going to put you on this chemo, and their patients say, well, what about taking supplements, or what about, you know, going to the Gerson Clinic in Mexico first and stuff? And they say as they're walking out, they say, you know, I legally can't tell you to do that, but if, you know, as a friend at this moment, if you want to look into that, then you should look into that. But they can't legally say that. They would get fired. They'd go to jail.
Are you able to give an opinion of chemotherapy as an effective cancer treating agent?
No, because I'm not a doctor. I'm a researcher and a counselor. I'm not against Western medicine at all. I say this, you know, page 2 of my book, I'm not against Western medicine. I'm studying people who've healed without it simply because no one was studying them. And I think that's stupid. I think it's stupid to not study people who are healing from cancer. I don't care if they did it by standing on their head for 100 days. If someone has turned around stage 4 cancer, I think we should study them. That doesn't mean that chemotherapy, surgery, and radiation are not the best tools that we have at the moment in terms of Western medicine. Best tools meaning most studied tools, I should say.
Would you please say something about the program you have coming up in San Mateo this weekend?
Sure, I'll say briefly, but unfortunately it's sold out. I'm just giving a 2-day workshop about how to apply these 9 factors into your own life. Again, knowing that, number one, I'm not a doctor. Number two, nowhere in my book or in my workshops do I ever say, if you do these 9 things, you will heal your cancer, because we don't know that yet. These are hypotheses. But what I have found out through my research is that all 9 of these factors have been studied independently by other researchers in other clinical trials. And what they've shown is that all 9 of these factors can help and can't hurt. The only one that could hurt maybe is herbs and supplements, but that's if you try to do it on your own. You have to do it with a health professional who's talking to your oncologist to make sure you don't overtax your liver with chemo plus herbs.
And who's sponsoring the weekend program?
Oh, yes. This is good. Thank you. The sponsor of my two-day workshop is a wonderful organization up in Sacramento called Healing Journeys. They are a nonprofit for cancer patients, and they give free conferences. I spoke at their free conference a couple years ago. They give free conferences, and then they do paid workshops. But it's all geared at cancer patients to try to give them tools that they can use in addition to chemo, surgery, and radiation, right? Because those aren't things that I can do, right? Those aren't things that you can do. You can't go give yourself surgery. But these nine factors and the other things that Healing Journeys talks about in their workshops are things that you can do in addition to try to help your immune system. Because that it's really about the immune system, right? What did Bill Clinton say? It's the economy, stupid, right? Isn't that what he said? All right, well, let me tell you what Radical Remission survivors say. It's the immune system, stupid. It's the immune system. We have a system here that knows very well how to pop cancer cells, but that system needs to be strong and it needs to be active. It needs to know to go look for them. And I believe that the common thread of all nine of these factors is that it's strengthening and activating the immune system.
And what part does gratitude play in that?
Gratitude is one of those positive emotions, increasing positive emotions. That doesn't just mean laughing. It means happiness. It means joy, peace, gratitude. Any one of those emotions will release serotonin, oxytocin, and endorphins into your bloodstream. And all three of those will instantly tell your immune system to make more white blood cells, make more natural killer cells, and, hey, we're happy, we're laughing. This is a great time to go around and look for disease and look for cancer cells. Because when your immune system is in the stress response, it says, don't work on fighting any diseases or looking for cancer cells. We've got a problem. Get ready to run. When we can get out of that, even for 5 minutes a day, and get into gratitude, your immune system shifts, your nervous system shifts over to the parasympathetic nervous system. Serotonin, relaxin, oxytocin, dopamine start flowing. And your immune system says, oh, there's no tiger to run from. I'm safe right now. And when I'm safe, I can work on things like digesting my food, circulating my blood to all of my extremities. And, oh, by the way, since I'm safe right now and we have some time and I'm feeling peaceful, I'm going to send these white blood cells and these natural killer cells around to go hunt and see if there's any cancer cells that need popping. Because natural killer cells can pop a cancer cell very easily.
Can we answer these two questions in maybe 2 minutes, Kelly?
Yeah.
Since 1,500 were not published, how did you find them?
1,500 were published. The 200 that I've found in addition to those have not been published. Go to PubMed.gov tonight and type in the words spontaneous remission cancer or spontaneous regression cancer, and you will see some of these. There's 2 to 3 that are published every month, new ones.
This is a very important question.
Yeah.
With targeted therapies and other new treatments, there's a growing group of advanced cancer patients that are neither cured nor actively sick and dying, which quite frankly to me is a positive. This new category of patient survivors living with these curious diagnoses and all the emotional difficulties that come with it, what advice would you give them?
I think that cancer is going to become a chronic disease that people have to manage just like they have to manage diabetes, or they have to manage, early heart failure. Just like I'm not against chemo, surgery, or radiation, I'm really excited about some of the new therapies that are coming up in terms of like dendritic cell therapy, immunotherapy. And all these things, by the way, the new ones that I'm excited about are working on getting the immune system to kill the cancer, right? Chemo works on trying to kill the cancer directly. These new therapies that are coming up don't do that. They get your own immune system to wake up. So I'm really excited about those. But it is going to lead to people who have a little bit of cancer in their body forever, for 20, 30 years. And for them, and many of those, I've studied many of those people, because you are considered in remission if your cancer is stable. So I have one gentleman who's had, he never got treated for his stage 3 lung cancer. He just did these 9 factors. And he's still got a couple tumors that have just been holding for 5 years. And he's like, oh, whatever, they're not causing me a problem. I don't bother them, they don't bother me. So I think eventually people will just keep doing these 9 factors, and that will maintain them in good health.
You're welcome.
Standing ovation around the world. Okay. Someone asked if there were healers locally, and they gave me this little note. On page 221, Kelly mentions the healing work of someone named Tom Tam, who works with cancer patients and other health issues. He's coming, or she, is coming to San Francisco and conducting a free healing session August 8th at 739 Bryant from 9 to 11. So you can Google Tom Tam in San Francisco. And this was someone mentioned in your book?
Yeah.
So that was, whoever shared that, that's lovely. Well, Tom Tam in San Francisco, if you just Google that. Our thanks to Dr. Kelly Turner for her comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. You can purchase memberships outside. Don't forget to look at the Health and Medicine Committee programs we have brought you for the past couple of years and hope to continue to bring you outside-of-the-box cancer programs based in science that allow you to know that there's a lot more that we can do. Cancer is chronic, and we can survive and thrive and conquer it. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 113th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.